Good evening. Welcome. So I saw some of you on this weekend's retreat with Narayan, and it was a lovely weekend, a nice way to practice. I'm even in the midst of Zoom. Zoom format seemed to work very well. So I'm glad to see many faces that were there this weekend and encourage people to try those out next time we have one. Well, tonight I'd like to use this anniversary of Earth Day to talk about climate crisis and wise intention, and how those relate together in our Dharma practice. So this Wednesday, April 22nd, marks the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And that, thinking back those 50 years, it was a time when people became really aligned around this environmental concern, how to protect the planet. There's growing concern around pollution, around the impact of humans on the planet. Our own Lake Washington was tremendously polluted. Like in the 1950s, they estimate 20 million gallons per day of sewage effluent was pumped into Lake Washington. And so they started to clean that up in the 60s. And so there's this growing movement toward trying to minimize the impact as humans are having upon the planet. Groups that have been fighting individually against oil spills, polluting factories and power plants, raw sewage, toxic dumps, pesticides, freeways, the loss of wilderness, the extinction of wildlife, they all came together, united around this Earth Day. So it's quite a momentous decision to bring this to happen, these 1970 Earth Day. It also had a rare political alignment that Republicans and Democrats, rich and poor, urban dwellers and farmers, business and labor leaders all came together around this common cause. As you look back these 50 years, we can see how much of an impact that Earth Day really had. Just on the very end of that year, they created the United States Environmental Protection Agency. And there's other laws that passed in the next years after that, such as National Environmental Education Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and the Clear Air Act, as well as the Clear Water Act. Endangered Species Act came soon after that. And so all these laws and all these policies start to really protect the environment in ways which have been profound, protecting people from pollution, from toxins, helping species avoid extinction. And obviously, this focusing had tremendous impact, this focusing of energy. Yet many of these issues still remain to some degree, depending on which country and which arena you'll look at. And now, 50 years later, we're in the middle of another crisis for the environment, and that is of climate change. A recent article in Lancet magazine, or journal, I should say, said that the World Health Organization has called climate change the greatest threat to global health in the 21st century. The greatest threat to global health in the 21st century. So it's this almost universally acknowledged emergency, yet we're still falling short on some of the very most important ways of addressing, such as greenhouse emissions. So obviously, a new commitment is needed, just as there was 50 years ago, that unites us not just across our country, but across the world. Because we know what to do, we know how we could reverse this, how we could slow it. We just need the commitment to do this. And how do we address this as Dharma practitioners? How does our practice come to bear upon this? There's actually many entry points that we can take into this climate crisis. And tonight, I'd like to explore wise intention in relationship to the climate change, the climate crisis. Now, as you recall, wise intention is part of the Eightfold Noble Path. One of some of the foundational teachings of the Buddha that laid out the way to the end of suffering. And wise intention, if you look at the Eightfold Path, it's preceded by wise view. Preceded by wise view. And preceded and informed by wise view. And this is really an important point, because view is always operating in our lives, consciously or unconsciously. You know, what is life? So when we bring that view in terms of the wiseness to it, it helps it form into the wise intention, which then moves, importantly, into wise action. From view comes intention and to action. And our intention is really an expression of our view, and our actions are directed by our intention. And this happens consciously or unconsciously. It happens wisely or unwisely. We're constantly making choices, making decisions in our lives, as we've been exploring in the Dependent Origination series, that these actions that we choose, they're really informed either by our wisdom or by our ignorance, by our understanding, or by our greed, our hatred, our delusion. And that shapes the very intentionality of how we intend our actions to go, to reinforce and express that view. And then that flows out to our actions. So we're always acting based on our intention. And our attention is based on our view. So how do we bring this into the climate change, this climate crisis that we are struggling with? Another way to say it is, what is wise view in relationship to the earth, in relationship to the planet, to the environment, to our place on the earth? This weekend, Narayan, as those who were there knew, we explored the Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes of metta, of compassion, of sympathetic joy, of equanimity. And one of the days I was out walking in my yard doing offering metta phrases. And as I was doing that, as I often like to do if I'm walking on the bare earth, is to walk with a quality of sensitivity, a quality of care. So instead of just tromping one step after another, to actually feel that, how soft can I make each step? Almost like it's a caress of the earth, feeling the sense of support from the earth and a sense of gratitude for the earth. This helps to start to shift us from unwise view. One way to express that is separation, that there's me and nature, there's me and the earth, there's me in you, this background fundamental assumption of separation. So starting to connect with nature in a way like this with walking meditation, or just going out and gazing at the clouds, gazing at the beauty of the springtime, we start to find ourselves opening toward non-separation. And feeling each step, treading softly, gently, sensing with care of each step, you know, noticing the early growth in the garden, the blossoming. And so there starts to be this shift toward caring for, of stewardship for, versus being a consumer of. So often we relate to nature as something to get something from, to consume, to harvest, to mind. And this starts to shift the earth from being, and nature from being something that's here to support my needs and wants, to me being here to actually support nature, to be a steward of nature. And this is this important shift that we need to make around climate change. This further shift from separation, even of me being a steward or me caring for the land, to realizing that I am no different than the very ground I was walking on. And the essential essence that there's this unity of nature and human, nature and people. We may forget this through our lifestyle of being in houses and having this sense of insulating ourselves from the rawness of nature. And yet, it's still a fundamental part of who we are. Essentially, we are nature, and nature is us. So I encourage us all to sense that when we go out into into the world, into the parks, into your yards, into nature, to sense how there's still a part of you that still is the same as what you're viewing, what you're perceiving. This starts to shift us into a wise view of non-separation. And from that place of wise view, wise intention then can arise. The Buddha talked about three aspects of wise intention, of non-harm, the intention of non-ill will, and the intention of renunciation. So these three elements, as we explore them in our practice and also in relationship to climate change, I think can be very helpful. The first one of non-harm, we often can connect with this in a much more immediate, personal way, that I am seeing how my actions cause harm or my actions are flowing from compassion. We work with the precepts and learning how to base our lives in an ethical way, in a way that's based in non-harm. One of the issues with climate change is there's a certain level of abstractness to it. There's a sense of being delayed in time, that how my actions are today, how they will have consequences in the future. It's not immediately obvious. It's complex. It's a complex of how this whole thing works. So sometimes it's easy to discount our own responsibility and our own influence within climate change. In this time, of course, also of COVID-19, we're starting to learn this element of taking something that's more abstract and learning to connect that with our actions, that how I act in the world is a way, can be a way of act being stewards of other people, choosing to wear masks, choosing to stay at home as a sense of acting in a compassionate way toward my fellow beings, doing my part to protect everyone around me, how my actions affect others. And we can learn to see with COVID, we can sometimes go into the fear of it, the fear of my own health, the fear of my loved ones, my people who are vulnerable. And I know many of us are in those vulnerable populations. And so it's not throwing out the wise discernment, but also noticing how we can shift from the fear of self-protection, the fear of my own safety, to the shift of caring for others. And luckily, in this case, it's the same actions. The same actions that you care for yourself also support others. So COVID can start to teach us this extrapolation of how my actions affect others. Now, climate change, it's harder to see clearly. And we can see the changes of temperature rising, of water rising, more intense climate fluctuations, droughts, floods, all these elements that can be shown to be directly connected to the change in climate. But how does my particular action of maybe staying in my car with the car idling, or my choice of transportation, owning a car or taking that trip or flying in the plane or whatever it might be, how does that affect climate change? It's harder to see it so clearly. It's not as clear as if I threw a stone and I could see the immediate impacts of its impact, of the harm, the damage it might cause. So climate change asks us to take a little bit of abstract thinking, of extrapolation, of how my actions, it seem like unrelated, have add up as I look around me. My actions and your actions and hundreds of other actions start to add up. The choices we make around, you know, who we vote for, how we invest our money, how we choose to move through the world. So this non-harm is so relevant in climate change. Again, so much harder to see it without reflecting on it, reflecting on the impact of it. It's harder to see the urgency too. That it's easy to say, oh, the climate change is out there in the future. which it is, but it's also happening right here and right now. It's just that slow, slow build. And at some point, we'll get to a place where it's very hard, if not impossible, to turn back from. It's like with smoking. You know, we all know and understand the health risk that smoking caused, that the increased of cancer and lung disease. But it's delayed. You know, we can smoke when we're younger and then have to pay the piper later on in our later years. It'd be much easier if we took a puff of a cigarette and we suddenly collapsed in an emphysema, or you know, had a very acute illness that came right from that. We'll see, oh, that's a cause and effect. You know, but because it's so spread out, it's much harder to see that. So this first intention of non-harm, even though it's spread out through time, even though it may not be so clear, still realizing it's still very valid, still very direct. So the next intention, wise intention I want to speak about is renunciation. Now, renunciation and non-ill will have a way of supporting non-harm. That often when we act from a place of harm, we act in a way that's causing damage to another person or another culture or the environment, we're often coming from a place of greed or hatred. These are often the principal reasons that we engage in these actions. That we often harm out of a sense of lack, out of a sense of desire, of want. And we discount other people's needs, other people's rights. We harm out of ill will, out of anger, out of fear. And so in this way, non-harm we can see as the fundamental intention, and renunciation and non-ill will help to support it. Now, renunciation is not the most popular topic in our culture. It's like, oh, I have to give up something. Not very, people don't usually sign up for those talks or those retreats. Because we like our stuff, we like our comforts. We live in a very affluent society. And there's also this newness of this immediacy of meeting those wants, those desires. We can get online in 2 days, get what we desired. We can jump in the store, at least we used to be able to, and go and search out whatever we might want to fill our hunger. And so then what happens is this immediate wants and needs has an urgency to it, a sense of I need to have this ice cream cone, this book, this experience. And if I don't act upon that, it triggers this underlying lack. It triggers this underlying sense of insufficiency. Really what happens is it allows that insufficiency to be seen, to be perceived. And but we try to fill that insufficiency through our desire, through our actions, through our wants. There's this base insufficiency that we try to keep filling with those objects of want. An author named Janine Roth once wrote a book called Feeding the Hungry Heart, looking at compulsive eating, and how she found that there's often a deep internal hunger for self-respect and fulfillment that can translate into compulsive eating. And I've always appreciated that title, that Feeding the Hungry Heart. And we tried to feed that, but it never gets to the actual pain. It never gets to the actual source of what is driving us. No matter how much we pursue, how much we want. There's an archetype in Buddhism called the hungry ghost. And this hungry ghost archetype is actually, it has a large mouth, but a very narrow throat and a very large belly, a very large stomach that's constantly needing to be filled. But the throat is so small and so convoluted, it's hard to get much nourishment through. And so this hungry ghost is constantly seeking more nourishment, more food, more pleasure, because it's insatiable. but it's in a place of, it's really a hell realm. It's in a place of deep suffering because it can't fulfill that. It can't, it's impossible to feed its appetite because its throat is so narrow. And this is what happens for us when we confront or we take on renunciation as a wise intention. The hungry ghost rears its head and say, what about my desire or what about my need? And we're often fooled by the expression of that, not realizing that that's that hungry heart is underneath that sense of tenderness. That's why we emphasize in Dharma practice so often this capacity to turn toward what's painful, what's unseen, what's tender, what needs acknowledgement, what needs compassion. Because so often our patterns of suffering are in relationship of moving away from. Right? Sometimes going toward what's pleasurable is as much as moving away from what's painful. So this essential instruction that we practice right from the beginning, a simple sense of renunciation that we all know is sitting still, sitting and not moving in the midst of a meditation. Even though the body may want to scratch an itch or get up and shift, that sense of, okay, I'm going to sit still right here. And that hungry ghost pushes and urges us to move and act. And so climate change and renunciation come very close together because our hunger, our comfort can contribute to climate change through our unnecessary traveling, through idling our car when it's too cold or too hot to make ourselves more comfortable. You know, perhaps how we heat our homes or how much we consume. These all can have contributing factors in driving the underlying consumption a mechanism that supports that consumption. Again, the tricky part is this, the effects of the harm, again, are removed. They're not immediately apparent. If I'm sitting with my family at home and we have a dessert, and when they're not looking, I take more than my share, I get to experience the impacts of that. I get to experience their disappointment or maybe their outrage at that, taking too many cookies. You know, so the effects are much more close to the actions. So I see it, I connect with it. But seeing how maybe the choice of idling my car, how does that have the impact? How does that sense of choice, of self-indulgence perhaps, cause that quality of harm? And it's further abstracted because it's not someone I can see. It's much more of this global change. And small amounts adding up over time. So it helps to very much reflect on how do my actions really do relate to climate change? How does it affect the earth? How does this lifestyle that I'm living? How does it affect fellow humans? How will it affect future generations? Trying to make this more concrete. Like looking at a young child and imagining what world will they be living in 20 or 30 or 50 years? What world will their children be living in? To make it from this abstract spread out through time to something that really connects with this moment's action, this moment's decision, can start to sober us up, to bring a sense of urgency to how to act, how to be. Aligning us with this quality of renunciation. And at the same time, I think it's very important to reflect on the good that we do. I like to share the story of Joseph Goldstein, who was on a retreat and having struggling with his critical mind. And his teacher said, okay, go into your room, your meditative room, and reflect on your ethical conduct. Reflect on your ethical conduct. And like probably most of Westerners, we go and reflect on all the times we weren't ethical. This is what he did. So he became actually more and more contracted. But his teacher, who was from a different culture, wanted him to reflect on all the good that he has done, all the good things he has done in his life, all the good choices the way he has focused on non-harm, on renunciation, and non-ill will, to brighten the mind, to bring that sense of encouragement, to focus on the acts of compassion. So I know many of us on the Sangha take climate change very seriously and have, you know, made choices to not have a car or to really, you know, use public transportation. Of how and those choices have effects, to reflect upon that, to brighten the mind around that, because otherwise we can become so caught in our worry and in our a sense of contraction of mind. And in that contraction, we become helpless, frozen. So life is always teaching us. It's always offering lessons, if we only have the willingness to hear and perceive those lessons. And this day and age with COVID-19 is teaching us many things. You know, the sense of staying at home order, the cancellations of gatherings. It's really a form of forced renunciation. So whether we want to or not, we're having to renounce. We're having to simplify. We're having to do without. I know some of us, this is taking us right on the brink of our resources, this brink of maybe past our resources. There's a sense of fear of survival. And other ones of us, it's more of a, you know, it's a hardship or inconvenience. And for, I think for most of us, it also brings up that quality of hungry ghost. I've been trying to stay home as much as I can, and maybe going shopping once a week, and just reflecting how often I would just run to the store just to fulfill that want, that need. And so this renunciation, this forced renunciation, starts to teach us that need, that urgency, that voice of the hungry ghost isn't actually so trustworthy. And we actually see that with a simpler life, that some of us can actually start to thrive. The sense of connection with loved ones may grow. The sense of alignment with what really matters may grow. I know this is not universal. Some of us, it's an extremely difficult time. So not to discount that. Not to discount those who are sick or have a family member who is sick, who's perhaps on the brink of living and dying. The fear that comes with that. Those without work, wondering how they'll pay the bills. Maybe the difficult home environments for some of us or the people that we work with. These are all true. And it's also true that many of us, we are okay, that we have enough to eat. We have enough shelter, that perhaps we have enough money, enough financial support. And to point how life is simpler, there's a simplicity that is sitting upon us, that's been enforced by the government, yes. It's enforced to help prevent the pandemic from spreading more. But we may find that there's more of a sense of sufficiency that we would have imagined possible in this kind of a life. That voice of the inner lack that says we must have, we need more of. Or something dire will happen. Have you ever played with that sense of, okay, I really need this particular thing. Maybe I need to get that extra cookie. I need to get this extra experience. Or something will fall apart of me. And yet, we haven't had those. We still are here. There's still a sense of living, a sense of sufficiency. We may actually find a deeper sense of connection. When that hungry ghost, that hungry heart is actually being fed. And of course, this simplicity that we are sharing not only in our communities, but with people across the globe. It's amazing how to reflect on that shared experience. That this simplicity is clearing air pollution. The children who have never seen the blue sky are finally seeing it for the first time in their life. As a species, we're living lighter on the earth. We're living in a more quiet way, a lighter way. And how much of this can be translated back to when things are more normal, How much can we live in a taking on renunciation because of our own choice, not because the governor has told us to? And renunciation becomes a choice. When it becomes a choice, it can become aligned with wise view. We do it because this is what our heart tells us. This is what our wisdom and our compassion tells us. To perhaps not always believe this hungry ghost of inner lack. Then from renunciation, the final wise intention is that of non-ill will. Now, some of the overt forms of this are hatred, anger, prejudice, bigotry, all forms of ill will. We focus on what we define as the other, those who are not like us. And we direct our ill will often from fear, for fearing for our own safety, our own well-being. We can direct ill will towards someone and it feels like it's justified that you're going to hurt me or harm me or steal from me. And I have to protect and I hate that I'm afraid of you. I hate that there's someone who's so scary in my life. Sense of powerlessness that this person in authority we have no control over. We can, of course, direct ill will toward nature itself when it's not doing what we want it to do, when it's in the way. I remember when I was in college, I had a friend I went to school with, and we went on some field trips for our forestry courses, actually. And he had very severe hay fever. So whenever we went out and looking at some natural phenomenon, and there was scotch broom there, he would take a stick and start to attack it because he figured, you know, that's causing my hay fever, so I have the right to destroy it, to reach out and destroy this, you know, invasive plant. You know, slapping at the insect that's biting us. How often do we discount nature because it's something that is not convenient for us, so it's causing us harm? So ill will, you know, has that expression, that sense of, I'm going to make nature the way I want it to be. Of course, that's what made our species so successful, is the ability to do this, to shape nature, to allow us to be comfortable, to have prosperity. And yet we need to learn to take that prosperity and bring it back to caring for nature and not forget that we have the responsibility to be good stewards. Now, ill will, I think, has a bigger edge for us. And that's the ill will that we feel toward people who are contributing to climate change. The ill will toward those who are ignoring the signs, ignoring the research, ignoring the science. And we feel justified in our rage, in our anger. Justified in our sense of separation. I am not like you, and you are wrong, and I am right. And in this sense of separation, this sense of view of separation, of being better than, we're justified in our discount of their perspective. We're justified in our need, our discounting of their needs. So we don't listen. We don't really hear what other people's needs actually are. And we tell the coal miner that he's killing the planet and ignore his cry that, well, you're going to kill me and my family if I can't make a living. So non-ill will allows us to start to connect with compassion. When it's supported by wise view, we see through that illusion of separation. We see through the illusion of self and other. So non-ill will allows us to connect with compassion, to learn to balance the individual with the collective, to balance the present with the future, and how this action, what we're doing right now, and how can we balance the present need with the future need? Learning to help find a way to support those most impacted by the policies and laws we need to reverse climate change and still caring for them. Now, if we stay locked in ill will, we disallow this. We say, just because I'm comfortable and my life has been supported in ways, I can be righteous. We cannot see why people would act differently from us based on our history. and they become the problem. And when we do this, it's really helpful because it's such a painful trap that I see we fall into, because probably most people listening are very much aligned with wanting to prevent climate change, to overcome the climate crisis. And this is a belief that we may all share. And yet we can still have that united with that sense of, okay, that people who don't understand climate change or don't believe in it, whose actions contribute to it, we can feel that sense of ill will building instead of that sense of wanting to understand their view. Narayan shared that this weekend, that the Buddha once said, if you feel justified in your ill will, if you feel like your ill will is justified in this situation, you don't understand my teaching. You don't understand the Buddha's teaching. There's a famous simile or sutta called the Simile of the Saw, when the Buddha, the way I like to reflect on that is, he kept trying to make this point of ill will is always this coming from a sense of separation. It's always coming from a view of self and other, no matter what the actions may be. And I can just imagine the people he was talking to kept saying, but, what about this situation? What about this issue? And he would keep making that more and more obvious. Till the end, he gives this graphic example. Even if you were attacked by bandits and tied down and they started to saw your limbs from your body, even then, no ill will. Even then, no ill will. So it's, you just had to keep pounding that forth. And the gateway to see that is when you get lost in the self and other, especially around something like climate change, that how can those other people be so ignorant and not following my view? To realize, okay, I am off in my underlying view. My view of separation has asserted itself. I've shifted from wise view. Right? So then we reflect on that. We reflect on these people have their own needs, their own desires. And that allows us to go into unity, into connection. And reflecting on this 50 years ago in the beginning of Earth Day, and how amazing that was, that people unified around this common concern. You know, that was, people were willing to set aside their anger, set aside their sense of other enough to unite. And from that sense of unity, their laws, the reforms happened. And right now we need unity. We need to be all in this together, because we are all in this together. This wise view of the reality of interconnection. You know, COVID-19 is teaching us that reality of interconnection, that how we care for ourselves, for our neighbors. We start to go outside this normal self-focus to realize my actions directly impact everyone else, and often at a great cost. And so how can we bring the same understanding into climate change, into climate crisis, allowing wise intention, renunciation of non-harm, non-ill will to guide us in our personal actions and as our actions as a human race? All right, so if you could just sit for a few moments and let those words settle. All right, thank you for your kind attention. And I'd like to open us up to any questions that might be out there. I want to first share the homework for this week, the practice and reflection, and I will attempt to set out to a chat for everybody. Okay. And we'll put that on the website too. So The practice and reflection, climate crisis and wise intention. So reflecting on what has living in a world of COVID-19 taught us about wise intention. Specifically reflect on non-harm, renunciation, and non-ill will. And how has our lives, how have we changed around that? The sense of intentionality, the sense of what does it really mean to be non-harmful in our lives? What is renunciation taught us, both in that relationship to the hungry ghost and the inner lack, and perhaps the illusion of those voices? You know, non-ill will. How can we meet someone who is coughing and sick, not with fear, but with compassion? And what lessons can we carry over to living in a world with a climate crisis? Because there's these dual crises that are happening. We often forget because of the urgency of the current COVID-19 and the mobilization. Well, there's this background boiling, this background increasing of the urgency that's arising. And can we live in a simpler way that expresses Wai's intention toward the earth? So that's the invitation for this week's practice, is to reflect on that, to see if you can see how those two are related. And then bringing that back to next week, we'll have some small group discussions. So if you would like to write a question down, you can do that in the chat box. So at the very center bottom, you can type chat, send it to everyone. And I'll give you the ability to unmute yourselves. And so I'll call on people. This is what Narayan did. I think that worked well, is to call on people, and we can have a dialogue if you'd like. And you're welcome to ask any questions or comments, not only around wise intention and climate crisis, but also dependent origination, or even just Dharma and life in general. All right. So Iris, if you could unmute yourself, if you would like.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you know, that point, you know, about ill will and separation vis-a-vis climate, you know, the climate crisis is so pertinent. And, you know, I can have sympathy for the mine worker who wants to support his family. And yet it's hard for me to have sympathy for the executives of oil companies. And, you know, but it's true. I mean, you know, any ill will is not going to help matters. And so, you know, I really have to dig deep to come to a place of compassion and care, so that, as you say, that my actions do come from understanding and wise view. It's a heavy lift for me.
Yes, and I think it is for most people. You know, particularly issues that we find very dear to the heart. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the paradox of Buddhist practitioners, of spiritual practitioners, and living in the world. Is how do we? Because usually we use that sense of anger, that sense of outrage, that sense otherness to mobilize, to bring our rally the troops. You know, it's like if we look at someone, you know, a lot of big changes in the world have happened because of that sense of isolation, that sense of separation, that we can make the other. And yet the Buddha pointed toward this, and this is perhaps what inspired Gandhi, inspired Martin Luther King, is to realize if we hold that quality of hatred in our hearts and we act from that, that is the echo that we'll receive. That's a sense of any of separation that gets more and more coalesced, more and more firm. And I think a way to play with this is that if you really want to be effectual in life, you know, like this, just interpersonally, like if I'm having an argument with my wife, if I really stay entrenched in my own views, the argument's not going to go very far, right? Because she's, you know, she's an equal person, you know, we're equal partners in our relationship. So there's that willingness to set aside my view to listen to her point of view, even though I think she's completely off her rocker or makes no sense. She's sitting right here, so she's trying to laugh too loud. So that sense of separation, you know, that maintains the conflict, maintains the distance. But they're being willing to really listen, you know, and this is hard if you think, well, you know, here's someone who's making billions off the destruction of the planet. How can I listen to them? Okay, that's the koan. And it's really the koan is like saying, okay, to get down to that point, well, I know I'm right. I know they're wrong. It can be that really, that hard edge of separation. Okay. And so the point I'm trying to make though, is that giving up that separation doesn't give up your effectiveness in the world. It actually enhances it.
Yeah.
Because then your actions come from a place of interconnection. You can say, wow, you know, I know it's you connect in a way that it's hard to imagine. Because you know, if you have a way of relating to someone, it's from that otherness, they tighten up, don't they? I'm sure you've experienced that in your own life, in the way that you've been made the other in different mm-hmm. arenas. Mm-hmm. You know, how hard it is to translate that. So this is where the Dharma practice takes a leap of faith to release that sense of otherness, that sense of separation. But yet that leap of faith, it's not falling into an abyss. It's actually falling to something that's very supportive. Mm-hmm. And it does need tenacity. It needs commitment. It needs endurance. Mm-hmm. You know, just as Gandhi and Martin Luther King found out.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Iris.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hi, Rob, you have something?
Yeah, hi, Tim. Thank you very much for your talk tonight. So you talked a little bit about releasing that sense of separation with other people, but how can I do that with myself?
Ooh.
Because I, you know, one thing I struggle with is I feel a lot of guilt. Hmm. You know, guilt about, you know, not really being able to do enough or not much. And that sort of, I feel stuck or frozen. You know, because there's sort of like this sense of overwhelm. And that kind of makes it hard to take the first step. So anyway, can you talk about that a little bit, please?
So there's kind of two elements that you spoke about. One is the element of that separation with yourself, that sense of otherness in yourself, that sense of judgment. The other part is the sense of overwhelm of like, how can I act in the world? Is that, you know, how can I act when there's so many, it seems it's hopeless or I don't know where to start.
Yes.
Yeah. So the first aspect is actually one of the most important things we can do to transform our actions in the world is learning to befriend ourselves in such a profound and deep way. You know, and this, you know, it's easily said, of course, but it goes into some of the deepest, darkest aspects of our psyche, of our wounding, of our lack, and learning to meet. And it's really what's happening is we're meeting these deep beliefs of not being adequate, of not being good enough, of not being lovable, whatever expression it might be. And these are some of the foundational pieces that create the sense of me, the sense of self, that sense of separation. And we sometimes learn that the proper way to relate to those parts of ourselves is through hatred, because that's how our parents did it, or that's how maybe if I wasn't like that, my parents would have loved me. You know, whatever that deeper confused logic that we created, this is this pathway, and the certainly interface between therapy and this kind of psychological work and the Dharma start to come together. We see that sense of separation. We find that the more we're able to do that, we start to find that the other and other people starts to fall away, that our own internal judgment is mirrored by our external judgment. Our internal separation is mirrored externally, and vice versa. Our internal self-acceptance, our internal self-metta is mirrored externally. And so that back inner and outer become very much united. So that's a core piece that relates very much to that the last question. The other element that you talked about is that sense of powerlessness, that sense of helplessness. You know, adding on the guilt, the not being good enough, not doing enough, that's kind of more the first. That's the second dart that we've added. You know, not just you, of course, but I think most people on the call will relate to that. The other element is how to be, if we kind of learn to clear away that self-recrimination, is okay, how do I act? And it seems overwhelming because there's so many, the problem seems so big. It seems so overwhelming. How can the little me make such a big action in the world? And this is something I actually learned from a young man who's in his early 20s or maybe a teenager. And he had read one of those self-help books on, I forget the name of it, but basically the message was that we need to learn to see where our sphere of power is. You know, where's that sphere of influence? And it's often we get overwhelmed when we try to extend that much beyond where that sphere actually is. And so we become actually less empowered. We become weaker. But learning to say, okay, where can I actually feel that sense of influence? There's my mind, my own reactions. Maybe there's the people I actually know, maybe my congresspeople. And you bring that into a very narrow, short way. And you start to feel all that influence. You can actually act with agency. You can act with skill within that. And then miraculously, then that sphere of influence starts to expand. So instead of trying to change the world, just try to change, you know, your mind, first of all. And so try to change your relationships. Try to change those who you touch, that you work with. How can I influence one person at a time? And this is, I think, is so helpful. This came up a lot with the last election cycle, that people felt this sense of overwhelm, of helplessness. Because they're trying to change someone who is so far away from them, something that was so much bigger than them, and learn to come back to where that immediate sphere of influence of action is. And then we can start to naturally expand from that. So start small and be sure to reflect on the good that you do. Because that bias of that, you know, we most of us share of emphasizing what's wrong, what's broken, we ignore the good that we do. So reflect on the good that you have done today, the good that you've done this week, this month. You know, I know with your work on the board how much good that you do. But the mind discounts that. It kind of brushes over that. So practice letting that in, letting in that sense of, you know, I have done something. I have done something.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Rob. All right, if there's anyone else, you could either type a question or you could just unmute yourself and start talking.
This is Ron.
Hi, Ron.
Hi. Often, or a lot of times I have, you know, fear from people who are at the other end of the political spectrum or, you know, don't see things in my point of view or what. But then I was traveling once and I t- told a woman where I was from, and I said, I'm from Seattle. And she says, oh, that's so scary. I don't think I could ever go up there. It just scares me just to think about it. And how, you know, how do we get to where we can acknowledge each other and move past that, you know? Because I've done it with some people, but it's hard, you know? It's, there's a risk always, but I'd like to get, find a way to increase, as you said previously, that sphere of influence by acknowledging other people and listening to what people who are different than us have to say.
I think that's, you basically said it. I mean, that sense of listening to who is other, like that woman that you met, and you could have asked, well, what's so scary about, what do you find scary about Seattle? You know, what is that fear about? And really listening, not with an eye to convince or to argue or to defend, but simply to really receive. I remember I was working with a couple people in a different arena in my life. And one person who was on the conservative side of the spectrum was saying, you know, I'm just really concerned about what's going to happen with our children, you know, in our for our children's world. I'm really concerned about it. I have a lot of fear for that if things go the way the other side wants. And the very next person said the opposite. I mean, said the same thing, but from the opposite side of the table, opposite side of the aisle, that I'm so concerned about what's going to happen to our children. And there's this common fear of what the future will hold. They, of course, have a very different understanding of what is dangerous and what's not dangerous. But learning to touch into that underlying fear, I think that can be the place of commonality, of common ground. And it takes courage. It takes the willingness to set aside our view, to set aside our opinions, our beliefs, at least for a while, not to abandon them, not to be, you know, a passive participant in life, but to connect with the other side, to connect with the other side of the issue. And then in that way, you are going beyond that sense of, as I spoke about a couple of weeks ago, the right doing and wrong doing that Rumi spoke about. The willingness to let the ideas of that go to connect with the heart of this person. And it takes tenacity, it takes courage, but ultimately it takes the willingness to connect. Anything else, Ron?
That's it for me.
All right, thank you. And Ken, you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about a different kind of courage, which is to kind of recognize how to work with the harm that we don't necessarily see, because either we don't want to see it or it's hidden from us, or you know, it's like built, it's endorsed by our cultural norms, and yet it's still just as harmful.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about harms that are outside of that field of wise view.
So how are they outside of the field of wise view?
Well, maybe they're not, right? Maybe that's not the right way to put it. Like, maybe with enough wise view, we can learn to see them.
So let me see if I understand what your question is coming from. So let's take two examples. Let's say one is maybe I have my unconscious white privilege and my understanding how my whiteness causes harm in the world. I just think, well, you know, I'm colorblind because I'm white. You know, all that stuff of ignorance, speaking from that ignorance, not understanding that someone else's experience in the world can be completely different. Or the sense of climate change is what we've been talking about, is that, you know, the saying that, well, it doesn't really matter. My actions don't matter. I want to ignore this, as Al Gore said, the inconvenient truth. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's more I think it's closer to the latter.
Yes.
Like, one thing that I've discovered is I have to pace myself, because every time I look too closely at some of the things that I feel like some, not all of the things that I enjoy in life, I realize that they're like much more problematic, and I can't keep doing them anymore. Mm. If I do that a little too much, a little too quickly, it's just like everything sort of turns into a giant bummer.
Yes, and that is a different kind of courage, you know. Especially, I guess a lot of it comes down to what is the motivation for the need to look, to keep looking, and where is that coming from? I remember years ago, I used to practice Aikido, and I was training with a senior person, and he was being kind of out of line, being a little too abusive, too rough. And I, at that point, I reflected that years before I would have just put up with it. It's like, okay, I just deserve to take whatever happens. But for whatever reason, in that midst of that, I stopped training with him. I bowed to him and I walked away. And that was a different kind of courage. And that made to confront with that sense of, you know, what am I worth? That sense of self-care. You know, that was more important to me than the image of what I thought I should be. And so with something like with climate change, or let's even look at COVID-19, just that we can become lost in the, you know, and how bad things are and how dire things are, becomes overwhelming. And it's learning to say, okay, how much do I need to really receive in this moment to make a choice, to make an action? You know, and when does my sense of mind become out of balance with the fear and the contraction, you know, versus having that place of balance? It's very similar to when we're practicing meditation and we find ourselves becoming really agitated or distressed physically or mentally, to learning that that's the time to shift our practice, to find more of a place of ease. So it asks us to be mindful of the mind as well as the object of the mind. So noticing when that mind becomes more brittle and more contracted, that courage to release the belief of you should be a good meditator, you should be a good climate change activist, and just stick in there till, you know, the fire burns you to the bone, is to learn to say, okay, it's time to balance the mind. Am I getting at your question?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I guess maybe it's a matter of seeing how awareness of the harm that we can do, consciously or otherwise, has to be balanced with the harm that we might cause ourselves, in whether it's the kind of guilt that Rob talked about, the paralysis of overwhelm.
Yes. Yes, yeah, I think that's nicely said, is balancing that sense of you know, caring for our own minds. And it's also helpful to reflect on intention. You know, if I'm not intending to cause harm, you know, it's and the action causes harm, you know, it's still, we need to attend to that. But we also have to realize my intention, it was very different than me intending to ignore, you know, something, or to actually reach out and cause harm. That's a very different, in terms of karmic consequence. It's very different than kind of just not realizing I'm walking across and squishing snails or something like that. It's like you didn't know you were doing that. And when you wake up to it, when you become aware of it, then you forgive yourself. Okay, well, I didn't know, but I'm going to make a choice to live differently from this point forward. So it's a process. You know, we still like to judge ourselves with our present understanding, you know, judge our earlier selves. We did the best choice we can in each moment. And we just try to do that, allow that capacity to grow. All right, thank you, Ken. All right, so I think we should shift into a few more things before we close out this evening. And I also want to thank the Climate Action Group at SIMS. So I know that Ken, who just spoke, and Iris, who spoke, are parts of it. And I think there's some other members too. But so thank you all for your good work around this. And there's hopefully will be a action, or a climate action half day in July, assuming that we can come back together. But we'll keep that posted. So I want to say just a few words about Donna, and then Iris has a few announcements to make. So Donna It's I was just talking with Narayan about this over the weekend, and how it's a very different, it's a different world right now for Dharma centers, for places like SIMS, and for Dharma teachers than it used to be. You know, there's, you know, so much of our normal, you know, revenue through Dana has changed or dried up, that for some reason people who come to online events don't offer Dana in the same way. I think part of it is just the convenience of pulling out your wallet and putting some money into the Dana basket and having to take an extra step. Of course, we don't want to discount the financial uncertainty and the financial fragility that many of us have. And that's one of the things I've always valued about the Dharma, is that no one's turned away for the inability to pay. That if you don't have money, if you're unemployed and you're worrying about making your next rent or mortgage, then come freely, come freely. You know, maybe volunteer at some point or something like that to keep the exchange of energy. But if you do have the means, you know, supporting or the organization like SIMS, you know, offering Dana to the organization, offering Dana to the teachers to help with their livelihood, because many teachers are very a financially uncertain time. They're living in, especially those who live on a fully on a Dana basis, like Tuareg does, there's just so little room for things being uncertain. And a lot of things have happened very quickly, that retreats that often provide much of the income have just had to be canceled because of COVID. So I know many of you are offering support, and I appreciate that. I thank you for that support. And just to continue to make that an alive relationship. So how can I support SIMS, or how can I support a Dharma teacher, to whatever means makes sense for you, for your individual, you know, life, your own individual livelihood. So I, on behalf of Seattle Insight, and behalf of all the teachers here, I thank you for your support. And also take care of yourself. You know, give without regret. Don't harm yourself in the midst of that. But if you do have some means, to offer that as you see fit. So thank you.